Okay, we're going to start the second session on Saturday. We took a little bit longer break, so we will still get all the time in that we need today. But this is at 3, 3, 1, so this is session number 8. And so all the files that will be loaded later for audio and video will be numbered accordingly. A8 for audio, V8. For V8, oh boy, I'm not going to think about vegetable juice. V8 for the video, but this is session number 8. So where we left off, we just show that last screen, was the Romans were coming, all right? And so I'm not going to make it large to go through each highlight there. But the Romans were coming, and the last thing we talked about in that regard was Pompey coming and how that's going to impact what's going on in the land for the next few centuries, especially in the context of what happened during the ministry of Jesus and the ministry of John. And so let's talk about Herod. We notice that Herod's father and Herod's grandfather, both of them were involved in the reign or the rule, if you will, of the Maccabeans or the Hasmoneans. And so Herod did not come out of nowhere. Herod had connections to the ruling people, priesthood ruling people, and government ruling people for two generations before he comes on the scene. And so what we're going to say about Herod is part of an ongoing tradition in the context of what his family did. So Herod is mostly known, and when we refer to Herod here, we don't describe him this way all the time, but there are multiple Herods that are mentioned in Scripture and that lived, and we're talking about the man known as Herod the Great. He's most well known for the slaughter of the innocent, and that's an interesting story. I don't say story in the sense that it's not true, but an interesting account. When the wise men came, I alluded to this the other day, wise men came, they were looking for the one who was born king of the Jews. Herod was appointed to be king by the Roman Senate. They had the authority to do that. But the child that was born with the inherent right to be king of the Jews, indicating that it was a divine right. And that's what caused Herod to be in such an uproar. And it says not only Herod, but if you read the text, it says all Jerusalem with him. And so this is the Herod that we're talking about. Let's look about who he was. We mentioned already, and we're going to go into more detail, he is a descendant of Esau, also called Edom, and the Edomites are also known as Idumeans. So lots of different people are referred to by different names. Babylonians are also the Chaldeans. The Edomites are also the Idumeans. And so we're not talking about two different groups of people, but two different names for the same group. And so his father was Antipater, his grandfather was Antipas. And so one of his sons and others are going to be named Herod Antipas. And so that name's going to show up in the name of other Herods in the family. So he's an Idumean. He's the son of Antipater. We saw Antipater was an advisor to Hyrcanus, that he was killed when Herod was a young man, and that dramatically impacted him. So the region of Idumea, or Edom, was annexed, conquered by the Hasmoneans, that is, the Maccabeans. And a lot of those people became Jews. There is the impression on the part of some scholars that the Maccabeans, the Hasmoneans, forced people to become Jews. And whether or not that's the case with the rest of the Idumeans, we don't know. But many of them converted to Judaism. Now, what does it mean to be convert to Judaism? It means that you were proselytized, that you became a Jew, that you weren't born a Jew. Was that allowed under the law? Yes, it was. Did that make you a Jew? Well, yes, as long as you understand that to be a Jew in this context, in this sense, did not mean that you were born of Jewish parents, but that you converted to Judaism. To what extent was Judaism binding on somebody who converted to Judaism? Just as much binding as it was on those who were born into the family of Jews. And so there is a huge Jewish connection with Herod's family and many of the Idumeans. And so that's part of the dynamic that's going to come into play as we see how Herod's going to deal with what's going on as he is serving as king in Judea. And incidentally, these slides are not up, but all the slides that are presented before this and all the stuff from the other document, all this stuff will be up at the end of the day or later today. so that everybody have access to it, and I'll send everybody an email. So everything that's here, you will have access to later in PDF format. Just a reminder.
I studied, I think it was Brother Jackson's on Acts, and it said that if they were proselyted, that they could not go into the temple. That
I'm not sure about that. I'd have to double check that.
And
I don't know.
That the
well, first, if they're here's
where
the thing.
They stoned Stephen.
Well, it depends on what part of the temple you're talking about. Only the priests were in certain parts of the temple. Only the Jews were in part of the temple, and then there was also a court of the Gentile.
But, you know,
so I'd have to check into that.
To a freedman's.
That's correct.
Where they stoned Stephen.
One of the things that Paul got into trouble with, he was seen in the city of Jerusalem with Trophimus, who was an Ephesian, who was a Gentile.
Right.
And they assumed because they'd seen him in Paul's company that Paul was later in the temple, that Paul had also taken this man to the temple. That's a false assumption. I saw you one day in town with X. That means X went wherever you went. Well, not necessarily. That doesn't mean they're the same. So Paul got accused of doing something that he didn't do just because somebody had seen him at some other point.
Well, one of the things I read was they were Grecian Jews that got so upset. I would double check about
how close that proselyte Jews could come in the confines of the temple. So I'll look at that more. All right, let's get back to this so I can get this done. So the Idumeans who converted to Judaism became Jews. All right, they may not have been Jews from the standpoint of it being born into it, as were all the other descendants of Jacob/Israel and the sons of Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, all the way down to Joseph and Benjamin. But nonetheless, they converted to Judaism. It became their religion. So they shared the Jewish interests. They shared Jewish interests in promoting national things and promoting religion and promoting culture. And so they were no less adept or adopted into what it was to be a Jew. So under the Old Testament, those who wanted to live within the confines of the land of Canaan and observe the benefits and the blessings that God wanted to give them became part of the Jewish religion. There wasn't anything that I know of that was kept from that, any restrictions. So it's interesting, and this is later, Herod's dead by this time, but many of the Idumeans who had converted to Judaism were involved in fighting alongside the Jews against the Romans when that battle started, the latter part of the 60s. And so that's how closely those people who had become Jews by proselytization or conversion rather than by birth, were involved in Jewish interests. And so that to say that the Idumeans had that level of commitment does not mean that Herod had the same level of commitment, all right? And so that's an issue that we're going to see going forward. So that's just a general thing with reference to those Edomites, Idumeans who converted to Judaism, of which Herod was one, how committed he was is an issue. To be discussed further. So, we mentioned Herod's father, Antipater, Herod's grandfather, Antipas, were both key figures in the Hasmonean rule. So, at least two generations before Herod, they were already involved in the politics, the priesthood, and major decision-making that was going on in the land of Palestine. And so, when Herod comes on the scene, this is not the year that he lived. These are not the years that he lived. That's the years that he was reigning as king. And so, he lived before that. He dies in 4 B.C., but he's living longer than that. This is his time of active rule. So he was a king in Judea for a third of a century. So that's a long time for somebody to be king. Our presidents rule for have office for 4 years or 8 years after Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected a third term. They had term limits only twice. So this is four times that. 4 times 8 is 32, and he was in his 33rd year. So that's a long time for a single individual to be involved in the goings-on in any particular country. Queen Elizabeth, by the way, you know, became queen in the early 50s. So she's been queen nearly as long as I've been alive. And so I think she's in her late 80s, if not early 90s. And so she's been queen like 60-plus years. My point is, when you're around that long and involved in a public influential position for that long, you can have a major impact on the nation, for good or bad. And that's not saying anything about the queen. I'm simply saying long-standing impact in Herod. And so who he is and what's accomplished during his time is in part influenced by how long that time was. During the reign of the Hasmonean Queen Salome Alexander, who was the wife of Janaeus. Now remember, after Janaeus died, his wife continued the political rule. And during this particular time, the Pharisees flourished and garnered a lot of strength and input in what's going on. So during this time, his grandfather Antipas was a praetor. We see the reference to the praetorium, which is where the Roman soldiers were kept during the context of the trials of Jesus. It makes reference to the praetorium. Well, his grandfather Antipas was the ruler of that particular enterprise, the praetorium, the praetor, or a general. He was one that was designated so by Salome, who's the wife of Janaeus. And so Janaeus, when he died, he left provisions for his wife to follow him, which was a very Grecian thing, not a Jewish thing. His father Antipater, we mentioned this before, and as we were going through the emphasis of Roman coming, the Romans are coming. His father Antipater was an advisor of Hyrcanus, and it's more than likely that during this time Hyrcanus and Antipater were in Jerusalem, so Herod may have been born in the city of Jerusalem. We don't know that for sure, but there's definitely a family history going back a couple of generations there. Now, this is interesting. Hyrcanus, who was a Levite from a Levitical tribe, remember Mattathias, his ancestor, was a Levite. He married an Idumean, and Herod, who was an Idumean, married a Hasmonean. So here's an interesting thing that's going on here. And I don't like the word breeding that I'm about to use because it sounds coarse. But there's a lot of interbreeding politically and economically to stabilize relationships and that kind of stuff that was going on in lots of different times in history. All right. If you look at, and one of my sons was talking about the other day, if you look at the quote-unquote kings and queens, and I say quote-unquote because a lot of them are just titles now. They don't have the functions that they do in Europe, in the continent, and in Britain and so forth. And you go back and look at the history, you see lots of king's sons were marrying, you know, king's daughters from the other lands. And they did that for political alliances. I'm not saying that no king's son ever fell in love with another king's daughter and it was just out of love. I'm not saying that never happened. But a lot of times that stuff was encouraged to say, I'm the king of X country, you're the king of Y country. If your daughter marries my son, we'll form an alliance. All right? Now, how does that work? Well, that's just part of the politics. If you read through the Old Testament, you see that Jehoshaphat, a generally godly king of Judah, formed alliances, political and business alliances and military alliances with wicked King Ahab. What in the wide world was Jehoshaphat, a godly, righteous king in Judah, having anything to do with an ungodly Ahab, whose wife Jezebel was a descendant of a priest of Baal who encouraged Baal worship and persecuted the prophets? Why would Jehoshaphat have anything to do with them? Well, if you look at it a little more closely, they had children that were married to each other. And so there's a family connection. And incidentally, Jehoshaphat was rebuked for engaging in that. My point is, sometimes these things were political and economic arrangements. I'm not saying it was always that way. But as we go further into the life of Herod, we're going to see that that's going to come into play. So Herod's mother, we only know her name. We know that she was a Nabatean. We don't know if she was a descendant of any Nabatean royalty, but that's suggested. Eretus and Obadas are men that were involved in royal positions among the Nabateans. We're not sure whether or not she was a Jew, so there's a question that's there. If this is the case, it should be a third-gen Jew, not third-ben Jew. Many of his brothers and sisters had Jewish names or monikers. And so the question, I'm going to fix that real fast because it's driving me crazy that it's there. All right? So he is now a third-gen Jew. Third generation is what that means there. And so many of his brothers and sisters had Jewish names. Well, what does that prove? Well, it proves at least that there's Jewish influence, and it may also indicate that he and others were also Jews. There is an indication that he was. So what did he believe? Well, we don't know everything about what he believed, but we're going to see some of that spelled out as we go a little bit further. There is some indication that he didn't accept some portions of prophecy in Scripture, which placed him in the same general ballpark as some of the Samaritans and the Sadducees, who did not believe in the authenticity or the authority and inspiration of all of Old Testament Scripture. So let's talk about government. So his father Antipater and his grandfather Antipas were both involved in the government of the Hasmoneans and the Maccabeans. And his father supported Hyrcanus, who was one of the descendants of the Maccabees, and he also was a supporter of Rome. So notice, Hyrcanus is Jewish influence, Rome is Roman influence. So you're kind of playing both sides of the fence here. And that was a typical thing. Jewishly speaking, I've got to be for this, but politically speaking, we need these guys' help. So there's a constant balancing act that was going on for the last couple centuries. Remember, when David was king, you didn't have that balancing act. You didn't have to worry about who was the priest because David saw to it that everybody was going to do the priestly thing in the way that they're supposed to, and the priest ran that business, and he supported and encouraged it and was very much involved in the proper worship of God. But you didn't have to worry about outside influence because David was a king, and as a military leader, he vanquished many of his enemies. But that's not what we have going on here. Remember, when Hyrcanus was chosen over Aristobulus, when Pompey came, he said, you can be priest, but you have nothing to do with politics and government anymore. We Romans are going to take care of that. And so Hyrcanus is religious leader now. At one point, the Hasmoneans had both religious and political combined, military combined. But now Rome's involved. Rome's been involved for almost 30 years by the time Herod comes on the scene. So Antipater provided troops and supplies out of his own pocket to help Romans. And this is interesting. He paid for this stuff out of his own pocket in order to help the country, but also in order not to cause Rome to have to pay any money. So that indicates he had some kind of wealth, right? When you think about troops, we're not talking about Boy Scout troops. You know, we're talking about troops, you know, guys who ate a lot of food that needed a lot of support that were going to be supported a long time. And so he supported small armies of troops that were going to help in and around the land of Judea. So that indicates not only wealth, but also indicates his where his alliances were. I'm going to support Rome as long as Rome is helping us. And by the way, I'm going to cover some of these costs out of my own pocket. We noticed that when we talked about Nehemiah, when he took the nobles to task for taking advantage of other Jews, he says, you're doing this for your own gain. He says, don't do that. And he encouraged people to be more like him. He did not draw any income, though he had the right to, as a Persian envoy there. He says, I'm paying all these things out of my own pocket. And so this the generosity of his grandfather's at least demonstrated here. Rich, you're going to say something.
Rome was okay with this.
Well, yeah.
The fact that they actually took military ownership, because it sounded like before that Rome was like, okay, you can do your religious stuff, but we're going to take care of it.
Yeah, but this Antipater's not calling all the shots. We're going to see later that he is going to be appointed to be governor here, and part of this because all the stuff that he's doing on behalf of Rome. So he's doing this with Rome's blessings. He's not doing this in order to defy Rome or take something away from Rome. He's doing this to curry favor with Rome. All right, so thank you for pointing that out. So Hyrcanus' influence is going to wane because he doesn't have political military stuff anymore. That's drifted away from the Hasmoneans, and it's going to be strictly a priestly-oriented thing. But Antipater's is going to increase. It's going to increase so much for that Antipater's declared a Roman citizen. Remember, one of the things that Rome did in the generations back, in order to bring people in and have people invested in what they were doing, they gave privileges. And one of the privileges they gave was Roman citizenship. What's that mean? You got benefits. All right? We mentioned one specific instance in which Paul is about to be beaten. And he says, you can't do this. I'm a Roman citizen. And the soldier says, well, I had to buy my citizenship. And Paul says, I was born a citizen. I've had this from childhood. I inherited this from my parents, but also because he was in a place in Tarsus where citizenship was granted. You could be a dual citizen. And so he was declared a Roman citizen. Well, that's a huge benefit that he had. So again, he has as an Idumean, who seems to have been very sympathetic to the Jews because he's doing all this assisting and advising of them, he has a declaration of intent in seeking Rome's favor as well. And I'm not going to stop every time I see a typo because I'll be making lots of stops. I see the word declares misspelled. So. But Antipater's declared a Roman citizen, and therefore Herod was a Roman citizen. Why? Daddy was, everybody in the family was. All right? So once his father was that Roman citizenship extended. It wasn't Roman citizenship just on Antipater. It's everybody in the family became Roman citizens. So the dividing line in supporting what's going on among the Jews and what's going on with the Romans, making sure that those things fit together and they're in balance. That's not just a Herod thing, that was his father before him thing. So Herod inherited that kind of, let's make sure as we tiptoe through everything, we keep everybody happy. We keep the Jews happy, we keep the Romans happy. And if we can do that, then everything's going to be great. Yes.
So, with Jesus, the Jews were not allowed to pronounce the death sentence upon him.
And that's because that was a governmental, political, military thing, not a religious thing. That's why we don't care what you do priesthood-wise. You know, you do whatever you want, but don't do anything that's our power.
But Paul was holding coats for those who stoned Stephen.
Yeah, yeah.
Death penalty.
Yeah, they did that kind of on their own.
That was what I read about. That was that it was just grassroots.
It was mob justice.
Yeah, it was.
It was mob justice. If you ever read the Oxbow Incident in the 50s, it's dealing about McCarthyism in disguise and so forth. I was just talking about the mob mentality. All right, now watch what happens here. Antipater's demonstrating favorship towards the Romans. He's paying for stuff out of his own pocket. He's doing everything to make sure Rome is fairly represented while he's protecting the Jews and the safety and the peace of the people. So he's not only made a Roman citizen, he is declared to be procurator and governor, right? And he's not declared to be a king. Herod's going to be declared a king. And so Antipater, because of his willingness to lend support to the Romans and keeping everything kind of smooth and on an even keel and keeping everybody happy, people think this guy can work for us.
So
all right.
Herod the Great started at Jesus' birth.
He was.
I said it wrong.
He was already in control from 37 BC and
Jesus.
Oh, that's correct. And this is what.
And
what,
then Herod Antipater was.
This is his father. This Antipater, there are multiple names. We got, and I have a chart. I didn't put it up, but I might share it later and put it. We may not use it during the course of the class. But there are a whole bunch of Herods. And keeping track of who they are, there's Herod Philip, there's Herod Antipas, who borrows the name of his great-grandfather because Antipas was the father. So Antipas that we mentioned already was Antipater's dad, Herod the Great's grandfather. One of the Herods later is going to be called Herod Antipas.
One that Pilate sends Jesus to. The night.
That's the other Herod that we're talking about.
Okay.
That's not the grandfather.
But that's
all right?
Not Agrippa.
No. We're just trying to. That's all right. I'll put a chart up, you know, and look at it so we can see all the connections because it can be confusing. And the other thing that's confusing, and I don't mean to go off on this, is there was a lot of intermarriage between cousins and aunts and uncles and whatever within the family. And so keeping track of who was related to who. And I don't mean to be crude, you know, somebody's married to their own grandmother, or, you know, things that are strange like that.
Marriage between the Jews and the Edomites.
Yeah.
That was.
Well, that's part of the thing that we've already seen here, that Hyrcanus married an Idumean, and also Herod, who's an Idumean, married Mariamne, who was a Hasmonean princess. So that's going to come up. All right. We really need to focus on this, or we're never going to get done. No, that's okay. So Antipater is going to become the governor, and Herod. This is the son. Before Herod becomes Herod the Great that we know, the king, he is a governor in his own right, working under the aegis, that is the auspices of his daddy, Antipater. All right? So Antipater is divinely appointed. He was appointed by the Roman Senate to be a governor. And Herod, before he becomes the guy we know as Herod the Great, is enlisted by Antipater to govern in Galilee. Now, this is interesting. When Jesus comes on the scene, a lot of his ministry takes place in Galilee of the Gentiles. And so if you look at the reaches of Jesus in the beginning of Matthew's gospel, he comes from Nazareth, he comes to Judea where he's baptized at the hands of John, and then he goes back to Galilee. Only he doesn't settle in Nazareth. He goes to Capernaum, which is on the Sea of Galilee. And so if you trace everywhere he is all over Galilee, Herod was very much knows what's going on all over Galilee because Herod was a governor in Galilee. So he's got his finger on the pulse of what's going on all over Galilee. So there's nothing that Jesus was doing in the context of his public ministry that did not reach the ears of Herod. He would have known those things. Now, I just need to shift here. I'm talking about the other Herod because this Herod has died by that time. But the other Herod that we're going to get to. And that's part of the confusing thing we mentioned before. They will know what Jesus is doing because of family connections going back a couple of generations in Galilee. So, you know, no modern means of communication, but people still talked and people still traveled. And when people talked and traveled, news got around. And so there wasn't anything that was Jesus was doing except that others are going to know about. And that's even in the political hierarchy. So Herod was admired by Galilean Jews and by Roman and Syrian officials. So notice, the Jews like Herod. This is Herod the Great now. He curried favor with the Romans, as did Antipater. So this is going to come into play with reference to what he's going to do. So his father was poisoned, and Herod sought vengeance and murdered or killed his murderer. He endeared himself to Hyrcanus. Now, this is the guy that his father, Antipater, was serving as advisor to. And because he endeared himself to Hyrcanus, who's the priest guy, he's going to assure his future role. Remember, Hyrcanus married an Idumean. And remember that Herod, an Idumean, is going to marry somebody in the Hyrcanus family, the Hasmoneans. Loyal to Rome, this is not the father, right? He's going to be appointed a governor by Sextus in 46. That's going to be reappointed in 42. His dad died already. So let's talk about the family dynamics. And this is an interesting thing. There's indication that he had at least 10 wives. And in 1 year, he divorced 3, including one who was a niece and one who's a cousin. So this comes back to what we talked about before. Keeping up with a family tree is kind of weird. You got the roots and the branches growing together. And I'm not trying to be mean when I say that. I'm simply saying it gets complicated. All right? And so he had 10 wives. And one of the things that we're going to see was that he was incredibly, incredibly paranoid about anybody challenging his right to be who and where he was in the political system in the land of Judea. And so I did not put all of this on the charts, but he killed lots of people in his family. He killed Mariamne, his wife. He killed his father-in-law. He killed brothers. He killed children. He killed lots of people. Why? Because anytime he got an inkling, a whisper of somebody plotting against him, he thought, can't have any challenges. This is part of why when he heard about a baby born in the city of Bethlehem, he went after everybody up to the age of 2 so he didn't miss anybody. Right? So Bethlehem was a very, very small place. And so the number of children that were killed were not in the hundreds of the thousands. There's probably maybe a few score or so. I'm not trying to diminish it. My point is, he didn't go in and just slaughter hundreds and hundreds of people. But given the parameters of the age in that area, he did not want anybody to challenge him. This is a baby. There's nothing a baby can do. But to hear about a baby who was inherently born with divine right to be king of the Jews, he wasn't going to have that challenge sticking around. And so notice when you read again, we alluded to this in Matthew chapter 2. It says, when Herod heard this, all of Jerusalem was in uproar. Why was everybody in uproar? We don't want Herod to get mad, because if Herod gets mad, he'll start killing people, right? And so he killed the innocents, fulfillment of what Jeremiah anticipated. And so this is just part of what's going on. He was, from every indication that I've read, was really truly in love with Mariamne, but he heard that she might have been plotting against him. So he had her killed. So she was the Hasmonean princess. She was the granddaughter of Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, the two brothers who fought against each other. So Mr. Herod was a very intense guy from the standpoint of getting what he wanted, currying favor with the Romans and the Jews and so forth, and even going to the extent of getting ready members of his family to protect himself. So later, he's also said to have married the daughter of a Jewish temple priest. So you got all these family connections that makes the political, religious, military stuff kind of weird. Am I going to do X for or against my brother-in-law, father-in-law, son-in-law, whatever? And it's not just that he's married to one person at a time. You mentioned before he divorced as many as 3 in 1 year. And the indication is he has had as many as 10 wives. I don't know if those are all at the same time or not. The point is, Herod, for whatever we might say about his willingness to curry favor with the Jews, was not as holy as he could have been from the standpoint of practice with reference to family dynamics. And nor were some of the priests. We saw before one of the priests would go out, you know, and make public feasts with all of his concubines. And this was a priest, mind you, supposedly. So Herod and others, this is what we mentioned before, often marry to gain political and economic influence. You know, want to have an alliance with you as a nation. Well, I'll tell you what, if you have an alliance with me as a nation, why don't our kids get married? Just a reminder, Israel is most noted, Jacob is most noted for having 12 sons. He also had a daughter, Dinah. So he had 13 children. And so if you look at the accounts that are presented in Genesis chapter 34, his daughter was defiled, and the indication is that she was raped and that she was not complicit in that whatsoever. Nevertheless, the young man that took advantage of his daughter said, "I want to marry her." And his dad got in touch with them, says, "We want our kids to marry each other. Let's see, your land's my land's your land, and we share everything in common, whatever." So they're going to form an alliance in part based upon this marriage happening. And Jacob didn't want any part of that. The brothers didn't want any part of that. And the brothers concocted a plan and said, "Okay, you want to be part of us? This is part of the conversion thing. You have to adopt the practice of circumcision." "Oh, we got no problem with that." So on the third day after they all circumcised, the brothers went in and slaughtered everybody. And Jacob says, "You've wrought folly in Israel." First time the name Israel is used with reference to anybody other than himself as an individual. But they attempted to form an alliance socially and militarily and politically based upon the marriage of their two respective parts of their family. That was a common thing that was done in those days. You know, I want to gain something somehow, and the best way to do it is to marry a rich man's daughter. All right, so we're still talking about Mr. Herod. So during later turmoil, and I did not chronicle all this because it gets a little bit complicated, Herod fled to Rome. This is in 40 BC. It's going to be another 5 to 6 years before he is going to come back. Now, during this time, there's a Y missing there. I'll catch that later. He's nominated by Mark Antony to become the king in Judea. And that, Josephus says that took him by surprise. So when he returns, he doesn't return as a governor. He doesn't return as a procurator. He doesn't return as some kind of low-level administrator. When he comes back, he's in charge of the whole shooting match, right? And so notice, he's not a self-imposed king like one of the guys that we saw before. He's not a self-imposed king like the latter guys in the end of the Maccabean Hasmonean period that assumed the right, and none of the others had done that, though they function that way. The Roman Senate declares him to be king. So this is why when Jesus' birth is announced and he hears that somebody is born to be king, that's not a Senate thing. That's a Jewish custom, tradition, religious thing, and that bodes ill for what might happen in the future. If that's the case, then he's going to get the favor of all the Jews because he's a born king. Remember, at his death, people mocked him saying, "You're the king of the Jews." They put it in three different languages on the cross, "You're born the king of the Jews." So what he was really born to be, he was mocked about during the course of his life, but Herod took it seriously. "I became king because the Romans made me this thing." And so that's how he's going to return. So one of the reasons why is Rome needed somebody. Remember, Rome didn't want to have to do all this stuff themselves. "We want you to help carry the weight, pay the freight. And so can you be this person to me, be this buffer between us and the Parthians over further east? We need to have this strong influence." And they thought he could do it. Remember, he'd already proved himself as a suitable governor in Galilee. His father was also a governor, and he'd worked with him. And so there's a history of the family showing a connection with Rome and deferring to Rome in many things. So Herod did that. So Mr. Herod, we mentioned before, Herod the Great, is going to be king for 33 years, a third of a century. So he establishes law and order. He creates a state that's going to rival David and Solomon's in size. So this is a big thing. Lots of expansion. He eliminates all kinds of local and domestic challenges. I mean, if he was willing to kill people in his family who were a threat to him, he'd take care of anybody else for sure. All right? So Herod's not, you know, a wallflower. He's not quiet as a church mouse. He's going to throw himself into stuff to protect his interests, and protecting his interest from his perspective are protecting the best interests of Rome, as well as keeping the Jews pacified. So we mentioned this already. And if you look at the long list of people that he killed, there are just a lot of people killing members of his own family. So if he's willing to slaughter the innocents whom he didn't know, and willing to slaughter members of his own family whom he did know, some of whom he loved, then he's certainly glad to take out other people who are going to be his adversary. So that's a Herod thing. So why is he doing this? Betrayal by a member of your family brought shame, because they didn't love you and respect you enough to let you maintain who you were and what you were doing, and that was a shameful thing. All right. Occasionally, in certain countries of the world, in Muslim countries, in Hindu countries, There are killings that take place in order to maintain the dignity of a family. You say, you know, my daughter or my son, whatever, brought shame to the family. And so they call them honor killings. In order to maintain our honor, we have to kill or get rid of what brought us shame. You might think, that's just, that's, I don't think that way. You know, that's not my upbringing. But here's part of the culture that Herod had been part of, is that when somebody was a challenge to his rule, it was a shameful thing for him, made him look bad. And the only way to make things look good was you justify your own self by taking these people out. If they were really loyal to you, they wouldn't be plotting against you or even thinking about plotting against you. So the reasoning there, again, if somebody in your family betrays you, you can't be really worthy of being in a position that brings shame. So the way out of that is to eradicate that. So notice he dominated lots of stuff that's going on, even was involved in controlling the religious council. So we have the council that was part Gentile, part Pharisee and part Sadducee. Let me do something real fast here. I'll do that later. Was part Pharisee, part Sadducee, and he dominated who was going to be on that and the decisions that they're going to make and so forth. And so Herod is in a position of extending his influence greater than anybody that's come before him with the full authority and backing of Rome. Full authority and backing of Rome. All right, so additionally, this is something else we mentioned, he has the privilege and the ability to appoint who's going to be high priest. And we saw this before, where some of the priests who were in the priestly line, may not have been the high priestly line, were buying the right to be priests. And they were outbidding one another to be high priest, getting others to help them in their quest to become high priest. And so it became a political hot potato, so to speak. And so Mr. Herod's going to throw himself into that, and he's going to be appointing priests, and that ends the rule of what the Hasmoneans were doing. So they lost the right to be both kings and priests, but at least they still continued the priesthood. Well, not necessarily. So, you know, Herod's going to be involved in determining who's going to be priest after that. So, again, that extends his influence into what's going on religiously in the land of Canaan. Continue his government. So he's going to continue to grow in favor with Rome. He gets to designate officials and successors. That's an interesting thing. And so when his father chose him to be governor, he did so with the blessing of Rome. And now he has the same sort of privilege that his father did, that he can choose who's going to be part of his government and who's going to follow him. And so we're going to see how he becomes enriched because of that, which is going to spill out into what he does in his public expenditures.
Before we get too far away from the point you made about him becoming involved in the appointment of priesthood, now he had the Jewish background, right, to be able to follow the correct thing to do, right?
Was you would think
still,
so.
Was he still allowing people to buy in, or was he following the...
I don't know of any specific instance where somebody bought priesthood. He just did it kind of ipsy-dixit, you know, because of his power. So I don't know of any specific attempt like we saw before where Antiochus IV was looking for money and people came wanting to buy X. He said, oh, wow, by the way, I need some money. You can buy that. And he took the highest bidders. There's no indication he did that, but he evidently switched them on his own for whatever reason.
And the contemporary historian probably didn't go into detail about how he did that.
Well, and the other thing is he didn't need the money because we're about to see Augustus, who's the Caesar, gifted him with copper mines. So he's going to end up having a lot of money at his disposal that he's going to spread around to curry even more favor. So he does that in building projects for Rome. He built Caesarea over on the coast that already existed, but he turned it into an incredible seaport. And the amount of money and work that went into building that project, I'm not going to say it's rivaling what Solomon did in the temple, but it was a huge thing. I mean, he builds a harbor. And to build a harbor the way you do it, you can't do it all on ground. A lot of stuff had to be moved in order to put, you know, building things into the harbor itself and to move the water around so it, you know, it's going to be the good harbor that it's supposed to be. And then he names it in honor of Caesar. It's called Caesarea. Where do you get the money to do that? Well, Augustus had blessed him with copper mines, the proceeds of which he used to build things. The building project, just a reminder, when Jesus says, I'm going to destroy this temple and build it in 3 days, he's referring to the temple of his body. But when people heard it, they thought of Herod's temple. And Herod's temple is an expanded building project off the redo temple that took place during the time of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Wasn't as grand as was Solomon's. But by this time, when Jesus said that, it had been 40 years in the expansive building project. 40 years. It's impressive, and we're getting off the topic just a little bit, but I want to make a point. In Matthew 24, 25, 26, that whole extended chapter, and even going back to early before that, all takes place on one day. As Jesus and the disciples are leaving the city of Jerusalem, so he's come, his ministry in Galilee, he goes over to the Transjordan, he comes down, and he comes into Judea, and the last week of his life, every day, at night, he goes to Bethany, where he spends the night, and every day, he comes back in the morning, and he goes in, he's preaching and teaching the temple area, or in Jerusalem. So they're leaving, and they're going up the ascent. So if you can picture, you're going up a hill, and the hill is going to go up towards Bethany and other places that are up on the hill on the Mount of Olives. And you don't have to get too far up the hill. When you turn around, the first thing you're going to see is the temple. And Roman historians have described it. There was so much marble and so much gilding on the temple that it blinded people from a distance of miles because of how bright white and how much gold was in it. It was just one incredibly opulent place. And so as they're going up the hill, one of the apostles says, "See how incredible these buildings are." And then Jesus said, "They're all going to come down. Not one stone's going to be left upon another." So the temple was one absolutely incredible, magnificent, building complex. It had been going on for years. Mr. Herod paid for a lot of that out of his own pocket. Where'd he get it? Well, he was a king, and he was a king that was enriched by the largesse of the emperor himself, and who used some of the money to honor the emperor by building the city and naming it after him. So Herod didn't have to sell resources, in order to get money. He didn't have to take bribes. He didn't have to rob the temple. He had practically an unlimited supply of money from the Roman emperor as long as he's doing his job. And so that's the kind of thing that he's wanting to protect, to keep this stuff going on. And so by this time, Herod the Great has died, but the process is still going on by those who are succeeding him. And so his sons are going to succeed him. They don't rule to the same extent that he did from the standpoint of the heir, but the influence is still there. So he rebuilds the harbor city Caesarea to honor Augustus. Where did he get the resources to do that? He didn't steal it from anywhere. He's getting it legitimately because of his position as governor. If he was involved in any illegitimate enterprises, I don't know any of those details. So this made him very, very likable by the Jews. And one time, he gave everybody's tax money back. So what does most tax money go to in most governments? It goes to fund the government. And so one year he returned all the tax money to the Jews. And I think there's an indication that he did more than once. The point is, he didn't need it. And if he didn't need it, and he could make people think he's better than he really was, I'm going to give you your money back. You know, what kind of tax refund you get this year? Well, I'm not just going to give you whatever, your tax rate says. I'm going to give it all back to you. So what? How's that going to work? They don't need your money this year. All right? That's just incredible. And so that increases his favor with the Jews. And so he may have been a mean, nasty guy, killed everybody that was a rival to him or was threatening to be a rival to him. But hey, I got my money back. And let me just say, this is not a political statement about what's going on in the world today, but most people vote their pocketbooks. I'm not saying everybody votes their pocketbooks, but a lot of people vote their pocketbooks. So you got a guy who's a ruthless, mean, nasty guy, but I get my money back. As long as he's not my house, I'm okay. All right? You might say, well, that's a weird way to do stuff, but that's the way a lot of people function. That doesn't bother me. So as long as it doesn't bother me, I'm okay. So Herod curried favor with people by using the resources that he had to help lots of people, all right, to give their money back. So he used his wealth to support the building programs, and the temple was just the most well-known, all right, because the temple was so incredibly opulent, and he poured so much time and effort and resources into it, it's just something you couldn't miss. People from all over the world, when they see the temple while it was still standing, that's all they could speak about. It's like they go gaga over this incredible building. Mr. Herod's the one who funded all that. So he not only is taking care of the Jews in the confines of Judea, but he's also protecting things of the Jews outside of Judea. He gave them worship freedoms. He said, I'll see to it, even though you're not where I am, I'll see to it that your freedoms are protected. You can keep the Sabbath, you can keep the dietary restrictions. Any money that you collect that's going to come to the temple, I'll see that it's protected. And so that's going to be kind of neat. People living in Judea, they've got family in other places, it's like he's looking out for their interest to help those people who are even closer to him. And so that shows a degree of nicety, but the nicety that he was demonstrating was always to protect himself, right? Somebody who's willing to take out family members and others who are his adversaries, he's only doing these things more likely than not to be nice, so he's taking care of himself. So the rumor is, and I haven't found confirmation of this, but scholars some think that he actually financed a synagogue in the city of Rome. Here's a way to curry favor with people on a larger scale. I'll help these people build a synagogue. Now, he's not the first person who did that. We see others, a centurion that's mentioned, who becomes a member of the church, who was friendly to the Jews and helped them build the synagogue, only he's able to do stuff on an even larger scale. So something about, we talked about his religious convictions, whether or not he did this personally or to make sure he didn't offend anybody, the coinage that was minted during his time was consistent with following Jewish protocol about using anything that was an image of anybody that would get any honor and glory other than God himself. And so he used coinage that was constantly consistent with the Jewish mindset. He didn't put images of anything that would draw attention to them as if they were being a pagan or an idolatrous image. Well, why did he do that? Well, it's a very small thing from one perspective, but it's a big thing, again, to do things that are consistent with what was going to make the Jews happy. And there are a lot of indications that indicate he respected the constraints of the Mosaic Law. Now, just a reminder, the Greeks started this, except for Antiochus, who was going to impose Greek worship, not just Greek culture. But the Romans did this as well. We don't care what you do as long as you still do justice to us. The problem that happened with emperor worship, they don't care what the Jews do. You could do whatever you want to do, but don't forget to worship these Roman gods in Asia Minor. That's more like Mr. Seleucid, but that's not where he was, all right? So he's following and allowing consistent constraints with reference to the Mosaic Law, thus emphasizing that. Now, we're going to take a break. My thing stopped, so I'm not sure how long we've been going. Okay, that's perfect, because we went 10 minutes over, we're going to go 10 minutes later. So what we're going to do in the next period, the last part of the thing after the break, is we're going to focus on the scripture aspect of what's going on. I want to talk, I'm going to use another book, this book here, I'm going to refer to. I want you to understand who Herod was and what Roman influence was by looking at two particular chapters of that book. I'm going to show it on the screen by using the ebook version of it. You need to see why the Romans did what they did. They did not care what you did religiously as long as it did not get in their way politically. And so the trial of Jesus for the Jews was all religious. From Pilate's perspective, it was all politics. If this guy's not threatening us and he's not a threat to Rome, I don't care what he's done to offend you. And that's why he says, I find no reason for death in this man. The Jews are thinking, he's blaspheming himself. I don't care if he claims to be God himself. You know, are you the Son of God? You say it. That was all they needed. The Jews rent their clothes, and the high priest said, what more do we need? The guy's blaspheme. Well, when Pilate heard that, he thought, who cares? I don't care if he claims to be 1,000 gods. He's not doing anything to challenge me in Rome. And so his innocence was determined on the basis of his legal status before Rome, not on the basis of his religious claim. That's a Roman thing. You can claim to be anything you want. Don't do one thing to hurt anything about the Roman Empire. And so that's rooted in the way Rome did government. You could get away with anything except hurting somebody else or doing something to infringe our Roman influence. And so Pilate saw no need to do so. Now, Pilate was right, legally speaking, because he wasn't a threat to Rome. He wasn't right, morally speaking, because he's going to allow an innocent man to be crucified. But that also curried favor of the Jews, because they're not going to say anything bad about Pilate. And if you read the rest of the text in that context, Pilate and Herod, who were kind of adversarial, they became friends after that. Why? Both of them wanted the same thing. Let's keep everything in the land of Judea running smoothly. If we have to allow innocent people to die once in a while, they're not going to come and take our authority away from us. Everything's okay. So that's ingrained in the powers that were established by Rome going back centuries, and why Roman law allowed them to have Jesus killed. All right, you're going to say something before.
Yeah, so is it safe to say that political appeasement for Rome was really, to make it in simple terms, financial appeasement, correct, and keeping the peace?
That's it. Just keep the peace. That's, you know, as you know, it, and you know, I hate to say this, but there are a lot of decisions made on the basis of peace that may not be peace that's really rooted in God's justice. All right. So you can have peace where there's no justice. All right. Let me simply, and this is not to encourage the discussion of all the horrible things that happened in the past. As long as people kept their place, and you can attribute that in any kind of society you want, and there's no uproar, we don't care what happens, right? Because there's a sense of peace there. Well, what if people are being oppressed? Well, is there a violent uproar? No, but people are being hurt. People are being taken advantage of. You might say, to what situation that applies? Well, let's go back and look in the Old Testament, where the Jews were taking advantage of other Jews, or where the Jews were showing kindness to people of another nation, of another religion, of another belief system, let alone ethnicity. God says, you don't do that. We read from this the other day in Isaiah chapter 1, where God said, here's the sacrifices I want. I want you to demonstrate concern and mercy and justice to the oppressed. What oppressed? Any oppressed. All right? Well, they're not involved in a violent uproar, so let the oppressed stay oppressed because everything's peaceful. All right? Well, these people are being hurt, maybe not physically, but they're taken advantage of, all right? So the Romans didn't care because it was still relatively smooth. That's going to drive what's going to happen in the context of Jesus. And I don't mean to overstate anything, but that's the kind of thing that they had to resort to practically in order to maintain some semblance of sanity throughout the kingdom. All right, let's take a break. We're going to come back, and we're going to look at these chapters talking about Roman influence. And then on the other side of lunch, we're going to talk more about the issue of Scripture.
Well, the Romans, Jehovah was basically just another god, and a growing number of gods and demigods.